Welcome to today's quarterly All Employment Network call. My name is Derek Shields, and I will be serving as the moderator for this call. I'm with the Ticket Program Manager. Before we begin with today's topics and presentations, I would like to cover a few housekeeping items in our agenda. Next slide, please. Here are some key points and reminders of how to make the most out of today's session. First, it's important to remember that the Ticket Program Agreement, Part 3, Section 11, Subsection I, this indicates EN staff are not permitted to record this meeting nor capture the transcript. TPM is capturing a transcript and recording and will produce an all EN call recap and transcript after the call, and we'll be posting that on the Your Ticket to Work website. Next, for questions, please feel free to ask questions today for our presenters. You can do those several ways. You can start by using the MS Teams chat. We do ask that you refrain from answering questions in chat that are intended for Social Security or TPM staff. If joining via phone and you wish to ask a question out loud, it's a two-step process, as it says on this slide. Raise your hand using star 5, and you will be unmuted. Then you'll be required to press star 6 to speak. If joining via MS Teams and you wish to ask a question aloud, you can use the raise your hand option, and then we'll call on you. Please do limit your question to one per participant so others can get their questions answered. If you have additional questions or comments, you can also email us at enoperations@yourtickettowork.ssa.gov. Those questions that aren't answered during the live event could be forwarded to the appropriate panelists so we can get back to you. For those of you interested in closed captioning, it is available for participants who join via MS Teams or through a closed caption link provided in chat just now. To turn on closed caption in MS Teams, you can go to the three ellipses at the top of the MS Teams window, click on More, scroll down to Language and Speech, and then click on Turn on Live Captions. When using the link option, you can take that link that's in and cut and paste that into your internet browser in order to access a full view of captions. We do look forward to your participation, and I'll repeat these engagement tips for our Q&A sessions, which we'll have two of today at each time we break. Okay, next slide, please. Now I'm going to review the agenda with our topics and speakers today. After we welcome new ENs, I will then introduce Vernon Collins. Vernon is here to provide a suitability update that will be followed by our first Q&A session. Next, we'll be joined by Natalie Sendeldorfer, and Natalie will provide an update on the Unique Entity Identifier, or UEI. Following Natalie will be Aaron Weidman. Aaron has some updates and reminders for ENs. And then we'll have a second presentation from Charles Killen on impairment-related work expenses, or EARLIs. And then we'll have an open Q&A session, too, for all panelists. All right. With that, we have 90 minutes for all of this content to include both Q&As, and we look forward to our presentations and exchanges with the panelists. So let's get started. Next slide, please. It is my pleasure to welcome four new ENs to the community of EN. First, Respectable Results LLC from Tennessee. Next, Amy Kutschbach, doing business as Ticket to Work Assist in Florida. Third, we welcome Transitional Community Services in North Carolina. And fourth, we also welcome Quest Employment Services, Inc., operating in Texas. So welcome to our new ENs. And with that, we should begin with our first presenter. As I mentioned, Vernon Collins is with us. Vernon is a supervisory HR specialist with Social Security, and Vernon will provide to us today a suitability update, and then we'll take questions from you. With that, over to Vernon, please.
All right. Appreciate it, Derek. Good afternoon, everybody. Probably still good morning to some of you as well. Again, my name is Vernon Collins. I'm a supervisor here for the contractor suitability team at SSA. I'm going to go over a couple of things that I feel may be important to you guys. It may be a refresher for some of you. For some of the newer ENs, you may find it helpful. And then, you know, of course, we'll be happy to take any questions you have, you know, once I conclude. So I want to start with just the regular submission process and then give you guys some tips on just how to avoid delays and just make the process go smoother for everyone. So first and foremost, when you are making your initial submissions to our mailbox, please make sure that you are password protecting those documents. You know, we want to protect your PII. Along those same lines, if later on in the process, if we require, you know, a new OF-306 form, which contains, you know, some PII as well, you want to make sure you password protect that even when resending. You want to make sure you're not putting your social security number within the body of the email and sending that to us as well. We only require two forms now. It's a lot more simplified than it has been in the past. For those of you who may still be submitting the Fair Credit Reporting Act form, you no longer have to submit that form to us. That form is now included within the investigation that the applicants are completing. So the only two forms that we need are our EAP applicant listing form. And on that form, it's an Excel spreadsheet, and you're more than welcome to list as many individuals on that form as you're submitting. You can put all 10 of those folks and their information on one form, and then you would submit each individual's OF-306, which is the second required form, individually, all within that same email to us. I would suggest that you may want to either do a part one or part two, or maybe just send max five or six OF-306 forms within one email at once, just to make sure that we get it due to size restrictions. You can also ask the mailbox to just confirm if you're submitting, you know, a bunch of applicants at once, just to make sure that we definitely receive that information. Also, for any applicants born outside of the United States, and this is regardless of if you're a current U.S. citizen or if you're still an alien status, if you were born outside of the U.S., please, for those applicants, if they're U.S. citizens, please provide an additional document, which the easiest one is probably the U.S. passport. Some of those applicants may have a born abroad certificate, or they may have a naturalization certificate. So please just include that as well, because that'll allow us to just verify the current citizenship, and we don't have to reach back out to you all to request that. If you do have applicants that are still in alien status, we just require a copy of their current work authorization document. That could be a permanent resident card. They may have an I-94 document, temporary employment card, whatever they have. It just has to be current, or they're going to reach out and request a current authorization document. And those are only for applicants born outside of the U.S. If you're born within the U.S., you know, you don't have to submit any additional documentation outside of that EQIP applicant listing and the OF-306. So some tips, and most of these tips are related to the OF-306 document. It's the reason for a lot of the delays, a lot of the, you know, requesting a newer version or a newer copy, because there was some information that was missing. So first and foremost, please just stress to your applicants and make sure that they completely fill out the OF-306 form. And that goes for just name. You know, the form at the top will ask for first name, middle name, last name, and then suffix. They don't have a middle name, they put no middle name. So just make sure, you know, whatever their legal name is, they have a middle name, that they're putting their middle name. If they don't have a middle name, then they can put no middle name. But just make sure all of that information is filled out. And then for questions 9 through 14 on that form, for any yes answers, If you look in the body of that question, it requires some additional information for yes answer. So, for instance, if we're talking about like overdue federal taxes, you know, they want to know the date, the amount, you know, the type of Fed taxes you're talking about, whether it's student loans or maybe just regular federal tax issues. So there's different layers of questions that they want answers to, and they will send that back to if it's missing one of those. So if they give us the year and, you know, and what type of debt it was, but they don't give us the amount, they will return that to us and ask us for the amount. So just make sure for any yes answers that they're completely answering all of those sub questions. They can submit an additional document to that if there's a lot of information that they have to put down. They can submit an additional, you know, document and submit that along with the regular request. Also, another tip is if you have applicants that do have student loan debts or some federal tax debts that they have payment plans for, we will come back in most cases and verify and ask for confirmation of those payment plans. So that's another way to avoid some delays, is to just have the applicant submit that documentation up front as well. And that would avoid us having to come back and ask for it. Same thing with, you know, arrest. If there's arrest within a time period on the form that they have, maybe they were on probation, you know, if they had to take some type of classes or anything, just anything to prevent us or avoid us from having to come back to get proof that, you know, the probation has been finalized, or, you know, the classes that they had to take as part of the disposition for a certain arrest has been completed. You know, they can provide that information up front as well. If you have some folks who maybe had prior military service but had negative discharges from the military, they may just want to include a copy of their DD-214 as well. Again, that way we can just verify, you know, everything that they've written on their forms, and we won't come back and request that additional documentation. Then also, we always stress in the initiation email that new applicants complete the application first and then get fingerprinted. If by chance, you know, you have an applicant that did things out of order, you know, you could just let us know right away, so that way we can go in and kind of put together the fingerprints with the EAP completion. A lot of you probably already know we do send emails when we get fingerprints in. We'll go to see if the applications have been completed, and in some instances they haven't been touched yet. Some instances the subjects are still in the editing phase of the application. We will reach out to you guys to let you know, so that, you know, you can get in contact with the applicant and make sure that they complete everything, so we can put that paperwork in the queue, so that they can be reviewed and get cleared. All right, next slide, please. For any new EINs who, you know, just started or just awarded December of 2023 up until now, you won't notice any difference because we had already transitioned to EAP. But for some of our veteran EN contracts, you know, pretty much November 30th / December the 1st of 2023, we officially transitioned as an agency from the EQIP to the EAP system. And we still had folks who were initiated in the EQIP system going through the process, but we've pretty much cleared all of those old EQIP folks out. So we're 100% EAP at this point in time. Now, with EAP, one of the main differences is for the older folks, of course, the older ENs, before you had to wait for our initiation email in order to get a registration code. that you would forward to the subject so that they can log on to the old Equip system to complete their application. So kind of a middleman in there. So sometimes that could create a delay. With this new EAP system, the emails go directly to the individuals. And just to be transparent, in most situations, those individuals are going to get those emails to start working on their application before you get the email letting you know that they have been initiated. It's just there's multiple systems that we have to use in order to set everybody up. So just the order of those and the new way that they have is going to lead to your applicants getting the email so they can actually get a head start on completing that application. So by the time you get the initiation email and forward it to them along with the fingerprint information, in a lot of cases, they're already going to have started working on the application. So they're going to get two emails from this do not reply at nbis.mil address. So one of the emails is going to contain their user ID, the form that they're completing, our organizational name, you'll see contractor suitability there, and then a link with instructions. So the other email that they're going to get is going to have their temporary password. Both of those are normally going to come back to back. So the applicants must click the link and they will enter their user ID, their temporary password, and the last four digits of their social security number. At that point, they're going to be required to create a unique password. And then after that password, they're going to receive a one-time passcode email. Every time they go into the application, if they save and stop and then come back later on, they're going to have to put in their, when they put in their username password to go back in, they're always going to get a one-time passcode email again, allowing them to re-access the application. And then once they successfully log in, they'll get a welcome to MBIS page that will display, and they can begin completing whatever form that they've been initiated under. I did want to kind of give you guys some kind of background on what the difference is between the old Equip system and the new EAP system. So under the old Equip system, there were 34 sections in order for applicants to complete, just the way it was broken down. The new EAP system only has 10 sections. So they shortened the sections. Also, everything is on the same page. They no longer have to click different links to get to the different sections. They can get to all of those sections on the same page and kind of see everything all at once. The new system has timeline validation, address checks, offers real-time feedback. They have section reviews, and then additional help menus within there. They also have a U.S. Postal Service address validation tool that will validate those addresses that they are using within the application. Some other benefits, for instance, on the old Equip system, if an individual was locked out, they had to request a reset from us. In the new EAP system, they can reset their password right there in the system. You no longer have to call us to get your EAP reset. So along with just, shortening how many pages they have to fill out and then adding in all these extra validation all these extra validation functions within the new system. Hopefully, we'll see a lot less returns due to missing information. One thing I wanted to point out was a pain point is the employment section. When applicants are filling out the employment section, they must list all of their periods of unemployment and every month. The form's going to ask for 5 years, and they have to have every month for those 5 years covered. So if you list, for instance, from, January 03 to June of 03, you cannot pick up the next one to be September of 03. You're going to have to July and August are going to be have to be qualified for. You're going to have to make sure that each month of that 5-year period, including any unemployment, is entered into that form, or else we're going to come back and either request that information, or in some cases, we're going to have to reject the application back to the applicant so that they can fix those. So just real important on that employment section. Between the employment section, making sure they give us verifiers who aren't family members, and that OF-306 form. That those are the three that are really generate the most follow-ups when we do have them with our applicants. So just to give you POCs an idea, and that's something that you can, you know, filter down to your applicants as you go to submit new individuals. All right, and you can go to the next slide, please. All right, so we've gotten some feedback from some ENs, and one of the main things we wanted to do was we have our mailbox, you know, where you guys submit all your applicants, but we do suitability nationwide for all contractors with SSA, so we get a lot of emails in that box. So what we're trying to do is lower the number of emails that come in that box to just really submissions only. Like we know that you've been given directions in the past to, you know, contact that box for, you know, your departures, or if you have a change in point of contacts, or, you know, any type of status check. So one thing we're going to do, we got a list from our EN folks here at SSA of all the active EN. So we're going through, and we're going to assign a POC, for each EN contract. And what we'll do is we'll send out a blast email, to you guys, to the current ENs with your POC, in their email address and phone number. So that if you do have a status check, like if you submitted somebody and it's been, you know, more than 5 days and you haven't received an initiation email, you can reach out to that actual individual. So you have a name of somebody you can talk to and call and say, hey, can you just check on the status of this? I haven't gotten anything. It's possible that the person could qualify for reciprocity, so there's not going to be an invite that's going to go out. But that's one of the things that you can find out. You can send your departure notices to your POC so we can keep up and make sure, you know, our inactive and active list are up to date. And then if you need to change the POC, the suitability POC for your EN, you can reach out to them and have that done as well. We ask that you not I know they have a TPA form that you guys normally submit with those changes, and you can still do that, and you can send them to us and copy the EN service mailbox as well. But we ask that you not make those changes on the applicant listing, because we don't really go off that applicant listing to go back and actually change updated POC. So it's still going to be very important that you go through the normal process to actually change a suitability point of contact. So each of you here very soon, you'll have a POC that you can contact to kind of keep that extra traffic from the mailbox, and also give, you know, SSA EN folks some relief, you know, from some things that they can't really take care of themselves. One thing that we've learned with the new system is if there's an SSN or date of birth error. So like if we fat fingered it, or what we try to do is when you guys submit those initial requests, we verify those socials and the date of birth and even the names, because we know that those are the things that's going to prevent an applicant from being able to complete it. But if you do get an applicant who goes in and they say, oh, my social security number is wrong, or my date of birth is wrong, Do not have them call that MBIS help desk because they're not going to change it for them. It's something that we actually have to call. Unfortunately, we can't. It's not an easy change we have to call to. But, you know, you can reach out to your POC and have them call and get that SSN or date of birth information corrected. And then the applicant will be able to go in and complete it. So you can save your applicant some time for those particular situations and not have them call the help desk. Just reach right out to the SSA POC. Same that if your applicant don't get the emails to log into the system does have the outages from time to time. So we definitely know of instances where those emails were not going out. Also, along the same lines of the SSN and the date of birth, it's going to be very important that you provide us the correct It's going to be very important that you provide us the correct email on that applicant listing form, because we've seen instances where the email has been wrong, and of course that's going to delay the applicant from getting the invite. And then we've also seen instances where we entered that email wrong. We try to copy and paste right off of that that Excel spreadsheet. So that's why it's very important that you guys use that Excel spreadsheet instead of sending like a copy. That's why we don't really want faxes any longer, so that way we don't get those type of mix-ups. But if your applicants did not get those emails to log in, you know, either you guys or them, they can reach out to the POC to help with that. Again, I already kind of covered, you know, some of the system glitches where the initiation emails have not gone out from the actual NBIS system. And then we've also been made aware from some of the ENs and a delay from them getting the invitations from us. And what we learned is, and it doesn't really affect any of the newer EN contracts, but some of the older ones that originated, went through our Office of Acquisitions and Grants personnel earlier on, but since no longer go through those are the ones where we've noticed the issues with those invites, like automatically going out, and we have to manually do them. So we have our IT folks working on that. So we are aware that sometimes your applicants have been getting their emails to start the process, but then you may not have gotten the initiations from them 3-4 days later, something along those lines. So we are aware of that and are working on that. And then lastly, one thing I just wanted to reiterate, if you read the suitability letters that you get for your applicants, it'll tell you that basically the process is really just starting, right? When we make your applicant suitable, the investigation part has just started. They basically have passed the pre-screen portion. So there are a couple instances where you could get follow-ups, all right? So one part of the follow-up is we made your applicant suitable. The information was forwarded to the Defense Counterintelligence Agency, who handles the backgrounds for the majority of the federal government. And now they've returned it to us. They returned it to us, and they've outlined to us what they need, and they've given us a deadline. Now, sometimes, depending upon what the issue is, they may not even give us an option to provide this information. They'll just reject it right back to us in the system. Like for PII issues, if somebody, for instance, if we were to release an investigation where the date of birth was wrong, that's not something that can be fixed by us attaching an agency correction form. The applicant actually will have to go in and fix that date of birth, and then we'll have to release it again. A lot of the questions that you guys normally get is when they'll send it back, but it, like OF-306 is missing something, or the application itself is missing something, and we have a deadline, so we're reaching out. If we don't get that information back to them in an acceptable format by that deadline, they're going to reject that investigation back to us. So now we have an applicant who's suitable and working, but they don't have an investigation that's currently ongoing. So There's a couple, aside from that, us reaching right back out, you know, soon after we've made an individual suitable. The other time is going to be during the final investigation. So we've released the investigation. It's gone through. It's closed. Now we have it and we're reviewing it to make a final. And then either based on new information, or it could be something that maybe the initial person who pre-screened missed, we now have to reach back out to get additional information. So a lot of times we hear from applicants that say, well, I've already been made suitable, you know. So that's just something I need everybody to just keep in mind, is that initial suitability letter is really just a preliminary letter. Everything is just getting started at that point in time. So there are different points during that process where we may reach out to the applicants. A lot of times if we don't hear back from the applicant, then we're including, you know, the POCs to get some assistance. But that's where those additional requests are coming from. We're trying to do the final adjudication and completely close out that file. But now we need more information. So just please be mindful of those requests, because everything is time. You know, we have a certain amount of time that we need to adjudicate by. We have a certain amount of time we have to return this additional information to DCSA, and so on and so forth. So those really the issues or new processes or even current processes that we wanted to touch on, just to try to maybe clear some things up that you guys, that I've known questions to come in about. But I'm happy to open it up at this point in time to answer any questions. Derek, I'll turn it over to you.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Vernon, for your presentation. And what we're going to do now is provide some reminders to folks on how to ask the questions. We already have some comments and questions in chat that we can bring up to you. But before we do that, let's go to the next slide, please. And one more. There we go. So just as a reminder, for those of you that have been using chat, you can continue to put questions in there, as Anna has just put. You can raise your hand with MS Teams, and via phone, you can do that with *5. And then once we unmute you and call on you, you can hit *6 to unmute yourself. And if you prefer, you can send an email to enoperations@yourtickettowork.ssa.gov. All right, so I know that we've had some comments and questions in chat, so let's bring Anna in and revisit a couple of those first. Anna, question for Vernon?
Sure. We have our first one from Justin Baker. He had an issue pretty much with the encrypted zip file. He sent it several times, 8 to be exact, and he was not successful sending the file. So I know one of your very first recommendations was to encrypt all the forms that need to be submitted. So he's asking if this has been resolved or if any other ENs have this exact same issue.
So it must be, I'm not sure what type, what form of encryption that he's using, but we can reach out and try to work with him one-on-one to see what he's submitting that's given us an issue, because all of our submissions come encrypted. You know, most of the ENs use the recommended password already. So we don't have a problem with the majority of them, but we can work. I forget what name that you gave, but we can work with him to, you know, see what the issue is with the actual request that he's sending. You know, so I can have somebody reach out to him. If you guys,
Vernon, Justin's actually raised his hand. So Catherine, if we could unmute Justin to see if he could explain further.
Absolutely. Justin, you're unmuted.
Thank you very much. So yeah, this was actually, I will say 2 years ago. Yes, the file, and I'm actually looking at the emails that were sent. It was sent a total of 8 times directly to dchr.ope, suitability. As well as multiple times over to Natalie Sendeldorfer and a couple others as directed by a few people. The emails, and I've confirmed when I was in a phone call with a person, the emails were received. The document was not, as in the zip file the encrypted zip file that was encrypted the exact way that the suitability process instructed us to do. Encrypted with the correct passwords, the setup for the password was correct. Everything was correct. But the file, the zip file itself, was not received. Has that issue been cleared up so that you guys are actually receiving things no problem these days? Because I had to send my information unencrypted, and that got me suitability.
Okay. I'm not aware of a widespread issue, but I like to work with you one-on-one just to make sure, because I want to make sure if you do send any additional applicants that you're definitely not sending those unencrypted. So maybe once you get off the call today, we can set up some time to do a test run where you send.
I'm already suitable. I already have it. Again, it took me sending my information unencrypted to get suitability. I have it now.
Right. So I know you
have I'm trying to make sure that it's not a problem for other ENs who are trying to get suitability.
Yeah. Well, I'm not certain of other ENs who's having that issue, but for you, if you are going to have somebody else that you're going to need to submit, we want to make sure that you know we no longer have the issue, because that's not a widespread issue that I'm aware of. So I don't know what encrypted style or version that you use where we couldn't get that that actual encrypted document to show. But I would like to at least make sure that if you send any additional people in, that that's no longer an issue. But I'm not aware what form of encryption that you use. So if you don't mind, at least just like to take a look at it just to make sure we don't have.
If you could reach out to me after this, I would appreciate that, because anytime I've tried to follow up on this, it nothing happened. So.
This is Derek. So, Justin, thanks for bringing this up. Anna and I will facilitate that connection with Vernon and troubleshoot. We'll determine if it was a matter of the encrypted file size. That was one item I heard earlier. Vernon was instructed to perhaps break these down. We can troubleshoot. And then, Justin, if you don't want to be involved, we can continue as TPM to try to work with Vernon to replicate. So thank you very much. Anna, let me circle back to you. I know there's been some other questions and comments since Justin placed that one in. Another question for Vernon, please.
So Stella is wondering why those from Omniplex reviewing the 306 forms not receive them from DCHR. I'm continually asked to send the 306 form to the personnel security assistant. Sometimes they request that I send it without the password.
So that's interesting, because in order for us to get to the point where your applicants have been initiated and have completed everything, we wouldn't have gotten to that point if we didn't have the required forms. So of course, the OF-306 is one of the required forms. Now, when you say they're asking for the OF-306, I wonder if they're asking for, is it corrections that they're asking for? Because they definitely should have that document. So that's something else. If you can give me some names that I can go back and we can look at to see exactly what the issue was with that. And then they should definitely not. That was one of my first things that I said. We shouldn't be sending anything unencrypted. I want to protect, everybody's PII. So definitely we'll want to look at that as well. And Ian, folks on SSA side, I'm getting the names, writing down the names, but I may need to know what specific EN they are after the call so that we can follow up with them. I got the name Stella, but I'm not sure exactly which EN that one is. So if you guys can kind of take notes
this
on that
Derek.
One.
We'll help facilitate that, Vernon.
So okay.
Thank you for that. And I see in chat, Stella also asked a question that maybe others are thinking too. So I'll read this one out. Is there a timeline for when the POCs with DCHR will be shared with the ENs? I think everyone's probably anticipating that transition to having a POC with an email and a phone number. Do you have a projected timeline for that?
Yes, we'll get that out by the end of the week. Just got the list that has all of them, just sorting through, and then we'll get that out to everyone. The Ian folks, you'll have a copy as well, so that way if somebody calls and asks you who their POC is, you'll have that information. But we're working on that right now. We should get that out by the end of the week.
Excellent. If, thank you.
Derek, if I can add another question related to the point of contacts. Tripp was wondering if this point of contact can only communicate with the EN's suitability point of contact, or if they can communicate with anybody else at the EN.
So,
meaning other point of contacts at the EN.
As long as we are aware of other POCs that you have, where I can update our system. It's the same as our helpline. They're only going to provide information to the POC that's listed. So if those ENs have an additional person that they would like to make a POC, you just have to let us know so that we make sure we update that system, because we just don't want to basically share, you know, this information with just anyone. But we can definitely have more than one POC. You just had to let us know.
Thanks, Vernon. Another question, Anna, from chat.
What is the time frame for suitability? I mean, for adjudication in general.
For adjudication? So adjudication can vary. We release these background investigations in the it could close. Some closed as early as 30 days, and then some may take as long as 6 months. Again, that part of the investigation falls under the Defense Counterintelligence Agency, and some of it just could be for, you know, the documents or the requests that they send out to the employers, to the verifiers, you know, waiting on that to return, waiting for, you know, any other information that they put in that document to confirm education and so on and so forth. So it could take 30 days to up to 6 months for the adjudication portion to close. Now, we normally try to catch all the major issues on the pre-screen, right? But then there are some things that come back at the adjudication phase that we were not aware of before, but we have to follow up and get either clarification or request additional documentation. Now, along those same lines, just timeline for suitability in general, really the clock doesn't start for us until the applicants have completed both steps of the process. So once you've completed your application and been fingerprinted, in order is when the time will start. So for instance, if we initiated an applicant back in April, but they didn't complete, you know, and they completed their application fairly quickly, but then didn't get fingerprinted until June, that's when the process really starts for us, is June, once they have completed their fingerprints. We don't count, you know, the 2 months that, you know, it took up until that point for them to complete both steps of the process.
Thank you, Vernon. So, Anna, time for one more question. Vernon is going to stay with us for the second Q&A portion two. So if we haven't gotten to every question, we can circle back at that point. But, Anna, one more question for Vernon before we move on.
Let's see. We have two comments from Matt and Stella that they have specific issues with some individuals that they submitted and they haven't heard for some time. Sometimes a couple of months, it was mentioned on the chat. So what will be your recommendation for them and any other EN that have submitted their documentation but they haven't heard yet? I guess after you announce the POCs, I don't know if you have a suggestion there.
if they want to send those requests, like right today, like right after this meeting is over, to the mailbox, we can get right on them. Or if they prefer to wait to get the POC list and then send them then, that's fine too. Technically, or I guess a timeline that you all go by is if you submit your documentation for your applicant, if you haven't heard anything within 5 business days as far as an initiation, again, sometimes your applicants already have an investigation on file with another agency, so they don't have to go through the whole process. We'll reach out and request the fingerprints, and then that's all they'll need to submit. But as a timeline, if you haven't heard anything after 5 days, that's a good point to at least reach out and just say, hey, can I get the status of this? Because I haven't received anything yet. And then once you're aware, and it's important to have your applicants communicate with you on when they have completed the application and when they have completed fingerprinting. That way you can have an idea of when everything has been completed. Because we get a lot of status checks. And we'll go in and say, oh, person hasn't completed anything yet. So to keep those type of requests, because we still want to get our work done, it's important that you actually have that communication with your applicant so that you know exactly when they've completed both. And then after the fingerprints have been completed, after I would say 15 days, if you haven't heard anything, whether it's a correction request or suitability letter, then reach out at that point as well, to get a status check. Like don't let it go past any longer than that. Like we don't really want to have situations where you guys are waiting, a very long period of time to get clarification to your question. It could be something that we're missing that still hasn't been completed. It could be a request that we've sent to the applicant that we're waiting on additional information for. So use those two time frames to kind of time when you're actually sending these requests out. So 5 days after the initial request, if you haven't heard anything. And then once you're aware that they've completed both steps of the process, if after 15 days you haven't heard anything, then reach out at that point to get a status.
Thank you very much, Vernon. We appreciate you being with us today for your presentation and also for this Q&A responses. There are a couple follow-on questions, but what we're going to do right now is proceed to our other presenters to make sure we get that information shared, and then we'll have you back in a little bit for our second Q&A too.
Okay, all right, sounds good.
Thank you. Let's move to the next slide, please. So now we're going to get the update that I mentioned on the unique entity identifier, and this is Natalie Sendeldorfer with Social Security. Natalie, over to you, please.
Thanks, Derek. Hi, everyone. I just wanted to share some information we received recently from SAM.gov that pertains to ENs with more than one ticket to work business model or ENs considering adding a second or third business model. They informed us that ENs will no longer be able to have 2 UEI numbers and registrations unless the business has more than one physical address or date of incorporation. Prior to this news, we required ENs to have a separate UEI and registration for each business model they have with us. I emailed all of the ENs with multiple models last month informing them of the new rule. And if you are an EN with more than one model, you can pick which EI you want to keep for ticket to work purposes and therefore maintain that single registration in SAM. Your separate PIN number, the separate PIN numbers will remain the same, and you will still be able to log into the Ticket to Work portal by PID like you do now. So if this pertains to you, please contact enservice@ssa.gov to my attention, and I will assist you with the process. That's all I have, Derek, unless there's any questions.
Thanks, Natalie. We'll bring you back in the Q&A. We appreciate the UEI update. And let's go to our next slide. For EN updates and reminders, we're joined today by Aaron Weidman. Aaron is a social insurance specialist with Social Security. Aaron, over to you, please.
Hello. So I only have a couple reminders and updates for you guys today. And actually, if you could go to the next slide. Thank you. So first, an updated request for application or RFA was posted on May 31st of this year. So So the updated RFA includes some clarifications and updates. First, in the section pertaining to the administrative EN business model, we clarified that administrative ENs must maintain, admin ENs must maintain a minimum of 2 provider affiliates, and admin ENs are responsible for ensuring that their provider affiliates meet and maintain the requirements identified in Part 3, Sections 1A and 1B of the RFA. We also made changes to the reporting requirements for administrative ENs. So admin ENs are no longer required to submit the monthly provider affiliate report, and instead they are required to report these changes in provider affiliates using the newly updated TPA change form. We also sent an email out specifically to admin ENs regarding these changes. Second, in the sections pertaining to the unique entity identifier or UEI, we updated the language to reflect the changes that Natalie just mentioned. Third, in the section pertaining to EN reporting requirements, we clarified that ENs are not required to report to EN service IWP amendments or ticket unassignments. Keep in mind that ENs still need to keep case notes and IWP amendments on file. And then lastly, in the section pertaining to security and suitability requirements, we updated the section to reflect the changes outlined in the December 1st, 2023 Gov delivery message with the subject new SSA suitability processing system and updated forms. So next, SSA is in the process of updating the employment verification process to ensure that we have up-to-date contact information and to ensure that portal users maintain that access to the portal. So the updated process will be a triannual process. As usual, SSA will verify the employment of all EN employees as part of the regular annual security awareness certification process in February. So when we collect those SSA 222 forms or amendments. Additionally, in June and October, we will verify the employment of all portal users and all main points of contact. So SSA, we're going to send out more information on how to complete this employment verification process very, very soon. So please keep an eye out for a Gov delivery message. As I mentioned, those 2 additional times other than the security awareness certification time is June and October. This year it will definitely be late June. So that's all I have. So back to you, Derek.
Thanks so much, Erin, for those EN updates and reminders. And we'll have you back along with Natalie in just a little bit for our next Q&A. At this time, if we could go to the next slide, please. It's now my pleasure to introduce Charles Killen. Charles is with the Policy and Innovation Team in the Office of Research, Demonstration, and Employment Support. Charles is with us today to cover impairment-related work expenses. Charles, over to you, please.
Hi, thanks, Derek. This is probably a topic or a work incentive that many of you are aware of. So we kind of wanted to highlight some of the many questions that we get about it and some of the basics for any of those that aren't necessarily aware about it. So with the impairment-related work expense, it's an expense for an item or a service which is incurred because of a physical or mental impairment and which is directly related to enabling the person to work. Now, why do we have impairment-related work expenses? Because as a work incentive, any of these type of expenses can be used to reduce the countable income for a person before we determine whether or not they're working at substantial gainful activity levels. So what are some essentials? An IRWI, the expense must be related to the disabling condition, it must be necessary for work, and it must be paid for by the beneficiary out of pocket. Therefore, it cannot be reimbursed by a third party, for instance, any insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, vocational rehabilitation, any other person. This cannot be reimbursed. It's paid for by the beneficiary out of their own pocket. Next slide, please. So with regard to the impairment portion of this, the physical or mental impairment must be one that the Disability Determination Services has established as the medical basis of disability, or, and this is the important one here I want to point out, any other impairment that is being treated by a physician or healthcare provider. So it doesn't necessarily have to be the disability for which the individual is getting disability benefits or SSI, but it has to be an impairment that is being treated by a physician or another healthcare provider. Next slide, please. And as far as being related to the disability, the expense must be related to that condition being treated by the healthcare provider. And the provider has to be a licensed or registered professional. Some examples would be nurse practitioners, chiropractors, dentists, ophthalmologists, audiologists, registered dietitians even, clinical nutritionists, psychologists, licensed counselors, all of those, of course, in addition to just physicians. Next slide, please. Now, the need for the impairment-related item or service has to be established where the person's disability is sufficiently severe to result in functional limitations requiring assistance in order from them to work. So this the expense or the item or service for which the expense is incurred is necessary to enable the person to work as a result of their impairment. Next slide, please. And the expense, the cost for the item or service must be reasonable. Now, generally, the cost will be considered reasonable as long as it doesn't exceed the standard or normal cost for the item or service in that person's community. Now, an expense of the item established as an IRWI can include any of the following. It can include the actual purchase of the item or service, installation of the item, maintenance of the item, and repair of the item. So all of these things can be part of an IRWI with the proper documentation. Next slide, please. So some examples of IRWI are following. Now, this is not an all-inclusive list, but we do include attendant care services, medical equipment, service animals, transportation, and one of our biggest ones are medication, drugs, and services related to that. Next example, or next slide, please. So with regard to attendant care services, the attendant care services can be at work or to and from work. So they're deductible if the service is needed in the work setting or in assisting the person in traveling to and from work. It could be attendant care at home. Now, these are deductible only if the services relate to the preparations for going to work or to assistance required immediately upon arrival home from work. This could include bathing, dressing, cooking, eating, administering medications, arranging certain medical devices. And it's important to keep in mind that these are deductible even if the service incidentally benefits other members of the family. So it's also important to point out in today's the way things are working, you know, if the person works at home, of course, attendant care at home would be deductible based on their the service that they provided the individual while working from home. Now, attendant care by a family member is something that we get asked about a lot. Now, generally, this would not be a deductible expense unless the family member has incurred a financial hardship, i.e. they lose paid work hours in order to provide the service. And if the payment is made in cash, i.e. not in kind, like they have to actually be paying their family member for whatever service they are providing. So we would require, if there is attendant care by a family member, would require some extra documentation to make sure it meets those rules. Next slide, please. When we talk about medical equipment, Durable medical devices designed for repeated use are primarily used for and are primarily used for a medical purpose. So examples would be like prosthesis, wheelchairs, dialysis equipment, respirators, oxygen equipment, pacemakers, inhalers, traction equipment, anything like that, similar items to that. Now, certain non-medical appliances may be deducted as an IRWI if they are verified to be impairment-related and medically necessary because it is essential for the control of the disability, both work at home. So some of those items might be, heaters or fans or physical fitness type, gym equipment, those kinds of things. Those could be IRWIs. They're generally not deductible, but they could be IRWIs as long as we can get a letter of medical necessity from the provider. Next slide, please. We do get a lot of questions about service animals. Expenses paid by a person with a disability in owning a guide dog or other service animal are deductible as an IRWI if the animal enables the person to overcome functional limitations to work. And that's the important part. It's to work. Now, some of these expenses could include the purchase of the animal, training the animal, food for the animal, veterinary items and services, and also different licenses that are necessary for service animals. The animal does not have to meet the ADA definition of a service animal. However, again, we will need to document the need and medical necessity by talking both with the beneficiary and their medical provider. Next slide, please. Transportation is another one that we get questions about a lot and is commonly used as an impairment-related work expense. Transportation costs paid by a person with a disability for travel to and from work are deductible if certain conditions are met. First, we'll talk about a modified vehicle. Now, with a modified vehicle, the cost of the modification, not the vehicle, would be an impairment-related work expense. Maintenance and repair of the modification, but not the vehicle, could be an impairment-related work expense. And also, when we're talking about a modified vehicle, the mileage to and from work would be countable as an impairment-related work expense. With regard to an unmodified vehicle, first we would have to verify, before we can count that as an impairment-related work expense, we would verify the need, the inability to use public transportation. So we have to see, verify that the vehicle is necessary because there's no other way for the person to travel to and from work. And in those situations, mileage allowance to and from work would be allowed, but there is no other deduction for other maintenance and repairs, oil changes, tire rotations, those kinds of things. Now, with regard to ride shares like Uber, Lyft, or taxis, et cetera, first, again, we're going to need to verify that there's no other type of public transportation available, say, like a bus or some sort of community transit. And the amounts paid for those ride shares should be reasonable amounts that are paid to the driver, and they would be deductible. And again, reasonable, we would use a similar type of comparison to make sure that what they're charging this individual is the same as or near the same as what they're charging other individuals in their community. And if the person's own vehicle is used, then we could deduct mileage allowance to and from work. Now, that would be someone else driving them to and from work in the individual's own vehicle. So those are some of the basics about transportation. Again, with a lot of the IRWIs, transportation for sure, these are all individualized. And so each case has to be looked at for its own unique qualities and see what can be approved and deducted and what kind of documentation is going to be needed. Next slide, please. So again, our big one, medication, drugs, and services. The payments are deductible if the items or services are prescribed and necessary for control of the disability to enable the person with the disability to work. Now, these do include, of course, prescription drugs. Now, it says over-the-counter medications here, and for sure we can count those, despite the fact that the definition says that they're prescribed. But what happens is then we just get documentation from the service provider, the healthcare service provider, that this over-the-counter medication is what's needed to control the condition and enable them to work. Other types of medical supplies and services, healthcare provider visits, like the cost of the visit, the copay, et cetera, all of those can be deductible as impairment-related work expense. And diagnostic procedures can also be an impairment-related work expense. So this would be, you know, something related to the disability is wrong or is happening with the individual, and they have to go get tests to figure out, is there other things that we need to do to make their ability to work, you know, better for them? Is there other things that we can provide for them? Next slide, please. Oh. Some examples of non-deductible expenses, these are expenses that wouldn't normally be considered an impairment-related work expense. Now, these would be routine annual physical examinations, routine optician services, routine dental examinations. The common word there, right, is routine. So this is just going to get, you know, your annual physical or get your eyes checked or have your teeth cleaned or have your teeth examined. These are not things that would be an impairment-related work expense. These are expenses that people may or may not have regardless of a disability. So we have to correlate these examinations with a disability. Health insurance premiums. So while copays and those kinds of things are deductible, the actual insurance premium that you pay, that an individual pays, would not be deductible as an impairment-related work expense. That includes Medicare premiums as well. Also, prescription drugs that are a violation of federal law, medical marijuana, cannot be deducted as an impairment-related work expense, even if allowed by state law and prescribed by a physician. And standard uniforms, so just a uniform that someone needs to have to go to work that, you know, the person next to them also has to have who doesn't have a disability, those would not be impairment related, so therefore they would not be an expense that we could approve. Next slide, please. We had a lot of questions about how the expenses can be or are distributed. So talk about the different kinds of expense first. There's the recurring monthly expense. That's the same or similar expense that occurs every month. So that would be like a monthly medication that the individual is buying every month, right? Or if they have to go for a certain treatment every month with their healthcare provider. That's a recurring monthly expense, and that expense would be deducted in the month it was incurred. Now, that's not the month it was paid necessarily. It's the month that the expense was incurred. Okay. Now, recurring non-monthly expenses. So this is similar to the recurring monthly expense, right? It's the same or similar expense, but it occurs less frequently than monthly. So maybe someone is getting their medications on a quarterly basis. Or they have to go once a quarter for a certain type of treatment. Now, that expense can be deducted entirely in the month the payment is made or allocated over the months in the payment period. So as a rule, this is up to the beneficiary how they want that to be deducted. But in many cases, the technical expert or the claims representative would go over, the claims specialist would go over with what would be the most advantage for the person. But ultimately, we would distribute it how the beneficiary wants us to distribute it. So non-recurring expenses, that's an expense with the person with a disability makes a one-time payment in full for an item or service. The expense may be deducted entirely in the month paid, or it could be prorated over a 12 consecutive month period. Again, totally up to the beneficiary, but we would try to work with them to see what would be most advantageous for them. Some less common but often asked about situations are a down payment for an impairment-related item or service. So this might be a non-recurring expense, right, but it costs so much that you have to put a down payment on it before and then make payments on it. So a down payment for an impairment-related item or service, that expense can be deducted entirely in the month that the down payment was paid, or it could be allocated over a 12 consecutive month period. Again, similar to the non-recurring expenses, but as you'll see with a down payment, the implication is that there's monthly payments coming after that. So if you have a down payment and then you are going to make monthly payments after that, we would either take the down payment all out in the 1 month that you've paid it, or we would divide the down payment over the next 12 months, and that would be added to whatever the expense was for your monthly payment for the item or service. And finally, rentals or leases for impairment-related items. If someone is renting an item or they're leasing an item, then the allowable deductible amount is the actual monthly charge. Next slide, please. So just a couple of examples to kind of go over some of the distribution there for you. These are simplified examples. You can put in any type of information here, but keep in mind that the ultimately the decision is going to be up to the beneficiary with some help and clarification from the claim specialist. So in our first example, we have a beneficiary who is earning $1,600 per month in gross wages. They have a monthly copay for medications of $75. So that's a recurring monthly expense. So countable income for SGA determination is $1,525. So you can see, even though they're making $1,600, we're only going to count $1,525 of their earnings because they've proven and documented that $75 were being used as an impairment-related work expense. Example two, if the beneficiary is earning $1,600 per month in gross wages and then make a down payment of $600 in January of 24 and recurring payments of $500 per month beginning February of 2024. In that situation, there's a couple of different instances. We could use the month of January of 24, $1,600 wage, $600 for the down payment, so the countable earnings in January would be $1,000. In February 2024, then their monthly payments of $500 would start coming out, so their countable wages would be $1,100 for the ongoing months and payments. Or if it works out better for the individual with regard to their countable income and what their earnings are, then we would be able to distribute the $600 and then make over the full period and make an ERWE of $508 per month. So what we're doing is taking the full amount of the item, including the down payment, and dividing it over the payment period. Okay, so just a couple of examples there. You can see how a lot of other things might apply there. Next slide, please. So with regard to proof and documentation, lastly, we want to talk about what some things we need that would be necessary to document the file and may be needed depending upon the item or service and the frequency of the need for that item or service. As a rule, we're going to need proof of payment. That could include paid receipts, canceled checks if anyone still used those, itemized bank statements or card statements, or a provider printout, like maybe from a pharmacy where they can show what the person's purchased this last month or this last year. Any of those things that show that the individual made a payment for the item would serve as proof of payment. A proof of medical necessity, when it's required, that would be a letter or other documentation from the healthcare provider. Now, that in some situations, medications, for instance, if someone takes insulin and their disability is diabetes, then we don't necessarily need a medical necessity letter because we already know that they have a condition that requires this particular item. So, again, each situation is unique and will be developed as such. But in some circumstances, like the ones we were talking about with maybe the need of some gym equipment or a fan or something like that, we would need a letter or other documentation from the healthcare provider. Now, we would also need, and it, sometimes these are in the same letter, but we would need proof of correlation to the work activity. So why is this item necessary to help the individual work? And in addition, from the healthcare provider, we could get a statement regarding their work activity from the beneficiary themselves, from an employer, from a VR counselor, anybody with direct knowledge of their work activity, and supplement that with the letter from the healthcare provider. And then that would suffice as our documentation. Now, I do want to bring to your attention that for impairment-related work expenses, the POMS reference is in DI 10520, and that's the table of contents, and then there's several references following that. You can also reference our Red Book. Specifically on page 13, it talks about generally about the impairment-related work expenses. So we appreciate the opportunity to highlight one of our work incentives for you today, and we're happy to answer any of your questions.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Charles, for going through the expenses and providing so many good examples. Anna has also put a link into the Red Book, and you can reference, and at least the PDF version, it's page 13 is where it begins, and I think goes over to page 14 as well. So thanks for all that. If we could go to the next slide, please. We're now set for our second Q&A session, just a couple of reminders about how you can ask questions of Charles, Natalie, Aaron, and Vernon on the next slide. We have the options. You can, via telephone, hit *5 and we'll call on you, and then you need to hit *6. Through MS Teams, as you have been doing, many of you, you can use the chat section to ask your question, or you can use the raise hand, and we'll call on you to ask that question aloud. So I know that there's been some activity and some responses from some of our panelists in chat, so we thank you for that. Let's bring up Anna and see if we could get a couple of the questions for the panelists. Anna?
Thank you, Derek. And thank you, Vernon, who has been actively answering some of those questions. But I have one for Charles from Jennifer. She says, I am working with a beneficiary that is finding difficult to fit all the airway information on the form. Do you advise to attach a separate sheet of paper? This individual was in a car accident and now is quadriplegic. They had to modify bathroom, hallways, kitchen, and so much more.
Yeah, for sure. I assume they're talking about the SSA 821, and that is not, it's less than a page of room, and then even the spots on the form aren't necessarily large for individuals who have a lot of different impairment-related work expenses. Two things. They certainly can provide a separate form. There's also space. There's a remarks section on the form, depending on how many extras. But even more important than that, it doesn't even have to be on a form. You know, it can just be in a letter that they write to us, itemizing their expenses. Of course, it would want to be submitted with the SSA 821 or work activity report if they have one, but otherwise it could just be submitted to the claim specialist working on their case. But yeah, great question. It does not have to be on that form in order to be considered. In fact, a lot cannot be on that form individually, because oftentimes a new expense will come up and we wouldn't have sent another work activity report. So they just need to contact the Social Security office and let them know who they are and identify themselves with the Social Security number and whatnot questions that we're going to ask them. And then we can let them know how to get us information about their impairment-related work expense. quickly, like if it is just a medication of some kind that we can easily correlate ourselves, then all we're going to need is proof of payment. If it's some other type of item or service, then we may we would then at that time let them know you need to contact your doctor and have them send something to you or to us and verify the need for the item and correlate it to the individual's work activity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Charles. Appreciate the question and that response. And it sounds like there's some flexibility there to make sure that documentation is submitted in sufficient format, especially when there's a lot of expenses. Anna, we have more questions coming into chat. Want to pick another one out for our panelists?
Another one for Charles. Does COBRA count as a deductible or non-deductible early?
I think you said COBRA. Can you repeat the first part of the question? I'm sorry.
Yes. Does COBRA count as a deductible or non-deductible early?
Yeah, that's COBRA, like the extension insurance, Charles.
Yeah, that's going to be treated the same way as an insurance premium would be paid. So, no, that's not going to be deductible as an impairment-related work expense.
Thank you, Charles. Appreciate the clarification there. If you want to ask a question aloud, please raise your hand and we'll call on you. In the meantime, we'll continue going through chat to cover those questions. Anna, next question, please.
I have one for Vernon. Once the EAP has been completed, signed, released, and submitted, do we have to send you anything else? Also, once the fingerprinting processing has been completed, does Fieldprint send you the fingerprints, or do we have to send you the fingerprints?
Thank you. Vernon?
Yes, thank you. Yeah. So once the EAP has been completed, at that point in time, the subject should go get fingerprinted through Fieldprint. You don't have to send us anything unless you learn that the applicant completed out of order. Then you want to give us a heads up. But we pull the Fieldprint report every morning for the previous day. And then at that point, we will go in to see if they've completed the EAP or not, and if they have, then that case goes right into the queue to be processed. If they haven't completed, we'll reach out to say, hey, you know, this person either is still editing the application or hasn't touched the application yet. Now, I will say that sometimes, and it's hard for me to know, it's hard for us to know who, but we get people who go get fingerprinted, and they're not in our system yet. So what happens is, We don't have any record of them. We don't even know who they are, how to contact them. And then in those particular cases, again, if you learn that somebody may have went and got fingerprinted out of order, just let us know. But as long as your applicants complete the EAP and then fingerprints, you don't have to send us anything.
Thank you, Vernon. Appreciate that. And another question from chat, please.
We have one from Michael. How do we submit the ERWI?
How do you submit the ERWI? Well, you need to tell us about it. And like I said, it could be on the form SSA 821 if you have one of those that you're completing. And then what happens is that we would, once those are alleged, either on the SSA 821 or in a letter or some other sort of statement that's either mailed to or brought to the Social Security office, you'll get a letter back telling you what documentation is necessary in order for us to approve the ERWI and start making the deductions. So if you needed me to clarify that, Mike, if you could just let me know. I'm not exactly sure where you're headed with that, but we just need notification of the ERWI, and that could be a letter. It could even just be a phone call, but that would be followed up by another letter from the Social Security Administration that is going to let you know that, hey, you let us know about potential ERWIs. Here's the things we need in order to make that happen for you.
Thank you, Charles. If there's a follow-up there, please go ahead and put that in chat, but there's a couple different ways to bring the information forward and to then have them react and tell if there's any needed supporting documentation, and then that deduction can occur. Again, looking in the Red Book, you get some reminders about some of the details in the presentation, and we'll include that in the meeting recap too. Anna, we have a couple more minutes left. Let's go over to Catherine. Sorry, I see that there's a hand raised. Catherine?
Hi, Derek. We have Michael. You are unmuted. Please ask your question after you unmute.
Hello. Thank you, Catherine. So I just wanted to make sure I understood the answer to the prior question about sending in ARIES. So you said it can be either a letter or a phone call to Social Security. Is there a specific address or phone number for that, or would it be each individual's local office?
Yeah, it would be the local office for sure that the individual is working with. Oftentimes these first come to our attention when we're doing a work review. So they will already have a contact of some sort with their local office. But once the initial review is complete, then there's not a certain individual that's always going to be handling their case. So it could be you could even just call the 800 number, who then would send a message to the local field office, who would follow up with that letter that I was talking about. That basically would, in all cases, we need something, right? In every case, we're going to at least need proof of payment. In some cases, we need more than that, and this letter that you're going to get is going to tell you, that the letter that the individual will get will tell them specifically what we need for each individual item or service.
Okay, and the letter, so let's imagine they're sending a letter. Would it be the employment network that should write that and say this is from the employment network on behalf of the beneficiary?
Well, technically it should come from the beneficiary. We have no objection to the employment network helping them to put that into words or putting it into, some sort of statement for us. But particularly an individual who's their own representative payee needs to take action on their own disability claim or review as needed. But certainly we have no objection to them receiving help on putting it to paper or putting it to a script for a phone call or something like that.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks so much, Catherine and Michael, and appreciate that response, Charles. At this time, we're nearing the end of our 90 minutes, and we need to move forward to our summary slide and getting you a couple updates around our next events. So the next quarterly All-EN call is scheduled for Tuesday, September 17th from 1 p.m. Eastern Time to 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time. If you do have topic suggestions, or if you have questions that you didn't quite get a detailed enough response today, we encourage you to send both questions and topics to our enoperations@yourtickettowork.ssa.gov email box. In fact, those emails have informed topics that we heard today, so we certainly appreciate those contributions. Also, we have two other upcoming events that are listed here. Our next WISE webinar is on Wednesday, June 26th from 3 to 4:30 p.m. Eastern Time. This WISE is entitled, How Will Work Affect My Social Security Disability Benefits? We encourage you to share those events through the Gov delivery messages and on your social platforms, and ensure folks register at the Choose Work website. Next, our July 10th EN Essentials session is scheduled. It's going to be a presentation by Laura Lee of the Job Accommodation Network, entitled Requesting and Negotiating Workplace Accommodations. This will help you increase your confidence when engaging with ticket holders and employers about reasonable accommodations. And while not listed on the screen, we do have a All-EN Payments call that's on our events calendar scheduled for August 6th. So keep that in mind. The link at the bottom, if you go to the Your Ticket to Work website, training events, you can find the 2024 calendar of events. We encourage you to pencil in these event dates. With all of the all EN calls, all EN payment calls, and essentials and WISE events. So please check that out. And with that, that concludes today's webinar. Thank you again for attending and have a good rest of your day.